This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So, Mathis.
The problem is that Christian societies may seem that it's not okay. So now they feel that I'm just like, what is the best way to get to that person?
The question is, we're discussing a question here. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. Let me just greet first and start the class.
وجعلنا ممن يستمعون القول فيتبعون أحسنه اللهم اجعل أعمالنا خالصة لوجهك ولا تجعل فيها حظا لغيرك وصل اللهم على سيدنا ونبينا مولانا محمد وعلى آله وأصحابه أجمعين والحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته We were just discussing a question, Brother Tawfiq had a question on the Jumu'ah that he listened to, and he was speaking about matters related to like LGBT stuff. And the question was basically that can a person that identifies, rectify me if I'm getting it wrong, can a person that identifies as one of those things be engaged, right, with the understanding that what they are doing is wrong? And I was just basically explaining that certainly the person can be engaged. And they might not accept from the premise, from the start of the discussion, that the action is wrong. You want the outcome of them to change. But the thing is, you don't have control of outcomes. You're never required to have control of outcomes. And all that you are, in fact, required to do in that regard is al-amru bil ma'ruf and nahyu anil munkar. Advise with good, prohibit the evil, but with wisdom. So that's why I said the important thing is to identify the source of the problem. Sometimes a person can have the problem simply because once I had to speak to a boy. I don't know if I told you guys about this before. I had to speak to, okay, also again, not a small boy. He's in his teens, latter teens. And initially, parents told me he's having doubts about his Islam. He's having doubts about Islam. So, first time I went to meet with him. He was very cool. He wasn't opening up much on what his issues were. In fact, I ended up just playing FIFA with him. But then the second time I went, and then he was like more ready to speak. This is the conversation. And initially, I started conversing with him, like talking about how to remove the doubts about the existence of Allah and prove so the existence of Allah. And that was where the conversation was going. But eventually, we went to go get a milkshake somewhere and then we were having a chat. And then I asked him certain questions, like, so what are your thoughts about those things? What are your thoughts about performing salah? What are your thoughts about? He told me, no, I don't have any issue with that. So at some point in the conversation, he identified the problem for me. He told me, you see, what it is I think that there's things that's haram, right? But I want to do them. And on account of that, I doubt Islam. No, but listen to what this boy's telling me. So if I think about it in terms of the makeup of the psyche that Imam Ghazali speaks about. And in light of that, this guy doesn't have a aqli problem. He doesn't have a wahi problem. He just has an overfed nafs. And when I look at it in light of other things, right, in light of other surrounding evidences, his lifestyle, etc., that's what the issue is. I don't actually need to talk to this guy about the existence of Allah. He doesn't have a problem with that. His problem is that he doesn't know how to restrain his nafs. In fact, like, it's so funny. He actually asked me, like, if I can go take him to buy weed. I was like, bro, your parents called me to sort this issue out. You asked me to go buy it. You know what they told me? There was another guy that they were speaking to before about this. You know, his parents hadn't spoken about him. That's why after the first time, they didn't initially call me. Then he told me, oh, no, the other guy that I was speaking to, like about the dini issues, he also smokes weed. And then I was telling him, he asked me, what's my perception of weed and stuff like that. So I told him, look, it's a drug, and if it has its harms, and even if you have good quality stuff, it can still have, you know, you can still have drug-induced psychosis, and it can still have all of those effects, and it's harmful. And I told him, no, most of the time people lace the stuff. He told me, no, I don't think my dealer will lace my drugs. So I asked him, why do you think that? He told me, no, he's just a Muslim. But, it's important to identify what the problem exists in relation to, and then you can solve it. So if any person struggles with a sin, no matter what the sin may be, it can be LGBT stuff, it could be zina, it could be drugs, it could be stealing, it could be anything. That problem stems from something. Sometimes it's something that an individual can analyze if they, you know what to be looking for. Sometimes it's something that the person needs professional help with. That's why we have doctors. You can sometimes identify this is a problem with the nafs. This is a problem with the aqal. This is a problem that I can't actually converse with you about. Maybe you need some medication. All of those things are to be taken. But we never think from an Islamic perspective that Allah would create a person without the potential for salvation. Without the potential for salvation. And I think that's important to understand. And it's important to also recognize that every person's test is different. Every person's test is different, but I should actually say every person's hisab is different. Not from the perspective of the challenge that they're facing, but the account that will be taken from them is also different. I always, you know, two hadith stand out in my mind about this. There's the guy that sinned his whole life. He asked his family to cremate him. Why did he want his family to cremate him? And then they must also scatter his ashes on the land and on the sea. The hadith is in Bukhari. Why? Because he sinned his whole life and he doesn't want to be punished. Right? So that, I mean, that is a worse thing, a bad thing upon a bad thing. And then he passes away. His children do that. They cremate his body. They scatter his remains on the land and on the sea. And then Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam informs us, Allah resurrects him, brings the parts of his body together and asks him why he did that. And then he says to Allah that I was shy to stand before you, have you committed, you know, lived that life of sin. And then Allah says, I'm shy to punish you. And then Allah puts him into Jannah. So you hear that on one hand, but in no way does that justify living a life of sin. Right? Because then there may be other examples of people who lived good lives, or apparently good lives. As a hadith, another hadith mentions, a person does the deeds of the person of Jannah. for his whole life until he's a handspan away from Jannah. And then he does the action of the people of the hellfire. And then on account of that, he gets cast into the hellfire. So we must be bayna khawfi wa raja. But the point is that there's a different hisab for everyone. And problems of this nature, where people are going to have confusion about their identity, where people are going to have confusion about reality, where people are going to have confusion about the validity or the objectivity of things, it's only going to increase. And our response to it can't be, okay, let me check you in the hellfire. Let me check everybody in the hellfire. That's not a valid response, man. It's not a sharia. It's not what the sharia requires of us even. Yes, there will exist in society that group of people that do take that position. And sometimes they must exist as a make weight. On the other side of the scale, there's a group of people in society that are completely on the one end of the spectrum. And then you'll have some people on the other end of the spectrum that, you know, balance things out a little bit. But generally, we aim to be moderate, follow the guidance of Islam, look for the salvation of people. And we do it with following the correct aqidah, following the correct fiqh, but also with the virtue of ihsan. You can't have the idea that I'm going to impose the fiqh if you're not coming from a place of ihsan. Otherwise, you're going to be just hammering everything and you think you're going to be imposing the fiqh, but you're going to end up with nothing. That's why we call it tazkiyah, call it tasawuf, call it whatever. That is the lifeblood spirit of Islam. So all of those things have to be injected into society through that spirit of ihsan, through that spirit of goodwill, through that spirit of bringing about beauty and all of those things. And I think a lot of the challenges that we face in society regarding the predominant philosophy in our time are things that, in looking in our Torah, in our legacy, we will find some initial steps to solving them. You might not know, but in many of the Maturidi, which is one of the main or the second most prominent madhab in Aqidah, many of their texts start with the phrase Haqa'iqul Ashiya'i Thabita. Something like that, like different variations of that. The realities of things are established and fixed. So it's like they're telling you, if I were to translate it into philosophical terms, they would be saying, as Muslims, we are realist. And then they'll speak about the mahiya, and we are essentialist. Like from a philosophical perspective. And then if you unpack that and understand that, then and that makes sense to you and you can convince somebody of that, then they will see the absurdity of somebody white identifying as a black man, or somebody identifying as something that they are really not, because reality has value and it has meaning. So, you know, those are conversations that we might have to have more and more. And it's not conversations that we'll be the first ones having. It's been had in human history. We must read and learn and know the source of the issues and then tackle them. So to me, when I went to have a discussion with that guy, we decided he's a female or woman, whatever the case was. I didn't even start by talking about it. I'm not even bothered to talk to this guy about that at the moment. Because it's already a problem that he thinks that he has the right to define his reality based on his thought. So let's talk about reality first. You know, then perhaps if we can come to some agreement on the terms of our engagement and our discussion, that we can say, okay, look, is there any, I mean, if I engage in a conversation and say, is there anything that I can say that you are bound to, things that we agree upon, you know, that we can bind each other to in the discussion? Because if there aren't such things, then having a discussion is really futile. So let's get to that point where there are certain things we can agree upon. And generally, for me, I mean, depending on, this is something that has to be assessed all the time. But the most important reality is Allah. If you want objectivity in worldview and all of those things, it starts with Allah. If you want moral objectivity, it starts with Allah. Allah is al-haq. You cannot be a Muslim and have an anti-realist worldview, because there's one essential reality truth that you will have to accept. It's not relative, it's not dependent on your perception, it's not dependent on your thought, it's not dependent on your feelings, it's not dependent on anything else. It is. And that's Allah. And that's why I used to have a thought that actually the more and more we're getting into this postmodern era, the more and more we're getting into it, it's extremely harmful and chaotic for society. But at the same time, there's a silver lining, that the choice between all or nothing becomes easier to make. And I think people still have the inherent recognition that, you know what, there is reality. Things are real. You might get people who study philosophy and stuff like that who will tell you, okay, I'm an anti-realist, or I believe everything to be completely relative. But if you go to a normal person and you ask them, like, is there reality? They'll tell you yes. And you, I mean, and if you tell them, well, but if you think like this, then the only way you can justifiably do that is if you accept that there's no reality. Then they will perhaps be able to see the absurdity of their position. So, yeah. Of course. But it has to be informed and wise dawah. It has to be dawah that aims at treating the very core of these problems.
What's the age of the person at the
football? He's a young guy.
So I can say he doesn't know his audience.
Perhaps.
Because the bulk of the people may not be inclined to those thoughts. I think they're probably
at the age, so must be a look here, it's an increasing. For some reason, I don't know where on earth I fell into this thing, but like, people ask me to come speak to their children and stuff, and I'm telling you, like, a lot over the past.
I don't think it's a Jumu'ah khutbah. I thought
it was a khutbah. You
thought what? It was a good talk with you. I think the general community must know about it. It's a lot.
Yeah, actually, when it's school, right? So whether you want, like, you
have a choice. You need to get the leader. At school now, it's like part of. It's a part of what the kids learn at school.
Yes.
I have an aunt that teaches at Islamic. She teaches Alam. In her class, she said that homosexuality is haram. And the girls wanted to have a petition against her. I think they actually did. And I'm not saying this to bash Islam here. I'm just saying that that it's so pervasive in society that like, the slightly, I mean, a generation of, beyond above me, they can think to themselves, okay, no, we're learning still with people, accept realities, but really, like, it's actually very pervasive in society. Youngsters, most of them, they have some crazy ideas. If not secular humanistic ideas, then, like, we think it, religion doesn't matter. Like, most youth that I engage, they won't see it a problem for somebody to reject Allah. as long as they're a good person. Like from good, actually almost all the people that I spoke to about this come from good Muslim homes. But at least like what we'd consider a normal Muslim home. I'm not talking about people, you know, half the family is Christian, so they might have an emotional reason for not wanting to accept such kind of thought or anything like that. Like just from a normal middle-class Muslim home. One guy even had to speak to became an atheist. That guy, he used to lead the Taraweeh head campus, 2.5 Jews a night. He used to take the guys to Fajr in the morning. He's not even from a Middle East, from a conservative Muslim family. And it's like, it's so much on the rise, it's like insane. So the only issue is, it's not that the only options people have is, you know, buying into nothing or Islam. There are other avenues. And there was one article, I think the article's on your team now. I can't really remember now, but it might have been Yasser Qadhi, who argued that based on a book that was written in 2015, and I think this is the name of the book, that the religion that youth are buying into, the philosophy that youth are buying into, because atheism is very unsatisfying. Right? It's very, very unsatisfying. It should lead you to depression and stuff. Is a morally therapeutic deism. And it's basically like people believing in something, but they're not accepting revelation in terms of the sources of knowledge. But it gives them the idea that there is something such as goodness and badness that we have to adhere to. It's very naturalistic, very irrational. But, you know, from our Islamic perspective, what you think is irrational is not necessarily irrational. Rationality has a very defined scope. And if you don't learn about what's the correct usage of rationality, you can be thinking that something is rational, but it's actually your hawa speaking. So you need to, you know, you need to be able to discern. And those types of discussions, our legacy is in abundance. We had the Ash'aris, we had the Mu'tazila, we had the Maturidis, they all engage in discussions of this type. So it's a difficult job, you have to read stuff and yeah, think about this stuff all the time. But it's stuff we have to deal with. We can't shy away from it. We can't and we certainly cannot let our response be chuck everybody in the alpha. So I don't know what the brother said, but likely I'm agree with him. But yeah. Where are we at? I think we can skip on and see how for today, inshallah. And just look at the Nahu. We don't have any projected again today. There's just one thing I wanted to mention to you in relation to the Nahu. So we're not going to do a new concept in Nahu today, but there's just one thing I wanted to focus on. Look, okay, that's another discussion I can just talk over there. Is there any input from you guys on this issue? Online, you're welcome to. No, no, just in terms of what I see now.
I think there's a great need that needs to be open and transparent about because a lot of times cultures it's kept under the carpet and we don't know how to deal with these things. I think it's good in some way dislike it, but I think it's good, especially sometimes we need from to the older people as well, you know, just to get a better understanding. Because generally the older people discuss it, it's simple, but you realize there sometimes there are underlying issues, but initially it is. So it's good that it happens. I think the problem is that I think we've been slow to react to it. A lot of schools where it's like, you know, it's almost like part of the idea at schools that you have to agree with LGBTQ, there's no single gender toilets, there's communal toilets for schools that it's male, female, so it's all about where, especially at that age group, you can be brainwashed into acceptance. And I think it's really important that we realize that it's not something that we should be accepting.
My brother is a teacher at South Peninsula High School. South Peninsula High School is not a Model C school. It's not like a school for only the privileged, whatever. But even he told me they had a meeting, a staff meeting, about this having gender neutral toilets. Well, it wasn't actually gender neutral toilets. There's more having transgender toilets. And the school is like half Muslim people. Principal is Muslim. The next in line that's likely to be principal. Okay, I can't say that. But other prominent teachers at the school are also Muslim. There's a lot of Muslim students there. But the principal told them, actually, there's actually nothing we can do about it. There's nothing we can do to, like, stop it if, you know, if it's pushed hard enough by the powers that be.
If we look at those international, I think it could be North African soccer players, but they're playing in France.
Yes, yes.
They refused to wear the soccer jerseys because it was prone to LGBTQ. And it was like...
They're finding,
but there's also like so much of condemnation towards him. Yes, he thinks it's kind of great.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's crazy.
But it was never enough, like especially the foreign just tell us this is not enough. They need to understand the people's error. Like you see, the conclusions like our concern is very thin, like LGBTQ. And Zini came to me and was like, just read this, but just know that this is what you're supposed to write. This is not my views. So this is like according to the textbook. But yeah, that is what...
I mean, it's problematic that kids are expected to espouse views that they don't know, okay, cognitive dissonances and stuff like that. But yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I don't know if I'm going to send my kid to school even. I don't know what I'm still figuring out. What I'm just doing it. I live in Gordon's, whatever.
I think that with the school situation, I feel like in our culture, parents don't engage on those topics, and it's almost left to the school thing to educate the children anyway, which I think that's probably the gap. So it's good that they are. By lectures and talks about it now, because like the question of the way do people who are non-Muslim, like good people, goes, honestly, it's not a high school. Like literally last week, my 5-year-old asked me that exact same question. So it's like, you know, like that sort of dialogue with children at a very early age, and they're not left to society to teach you about morality and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable.
Yeah, I know it's you know, even SubhanAllah, yesterday was a year since Mawlana passed away, rahimahullah. And Mawlana was immersed like in his focus of his efforts were primarily on hadith and on fiqh. He was a polymath, so he was like a super good in a large variety of subjects. But like in the latter part of his life, even he like changed his focus a lot to matters of aqidah and stuff like that, because that's where the problems of our time lie. It's crazy. But sometimes I actually sit and I just think, yo, the world is bonkers. Like, yeah.
Like there's no, it's not
practical. Yeah, I mean, I'm still alhamdulillah. quite young. I mean, it wasn't. what I mean is, like, I was at school, like, maybe 13 years ago. And, like, what the situation was at school 13 years ago to what it is now, it's just, like, worlds apart. And that rapid change is dangerous because you have to have a rapid production of responses also.
And the things that was then, yeah, it was simple. Mm. But now it's changing, like, you know, person's identity, what they believe in, and all of this, like, in a short space of time, it's gone from, I mean, back then, it could have been, you know, drugs and alcohol, but now it's gone to changing people's beliefs and.
And so what is so different now? Because we were also exposed to what is the Christian school.
Yeah, but Christian is a Christian value. I was at SP also, we also used to say the voice boom. That's really different. Really different.
Anyone has a discussion with students, you might have a say about times where there would have been an uproar by the students themselves, think Muslim or non Muslim alike. So it's just interesting. Like, and I saw on the Facebook page that was supposed to like a downing thing from the school, but it just said we don't discriminate against, or like we don't believe in bullying or anything like that. But it was still like it's very different from maybe.
And I think also, you know, one of the subtle things that create a bigger problem or effective in their cause is that they use things that are laden with positive connotations. To, like, I'm sometimes scared when my kid watches something with rainbows in it. Just because he's going to associate rainbows with goodness, and then it goes into society and the rainbows are associated with all types of other things. My brother-in-law was in Germany. He went to a soccer match the other day. He sends a photo of the stadium. The whole stadium, Bayern Munich Stadium, is in the rainbow colors. Right? He sends it, oh, look how cool the stadium looks at that in Brugge. it's all over the placements. Occupying positions of power in terms of ideas. I mean, there might be all of those types of benefit, but also if you occupy positions of ideological power, then you can impose it, even if you're a small number.
Started off as comedy, so like socializing that type of behavior in like the comic sense, and then you know, like, because even like outside of Islam, you know, homosexuality was very much the goal for like even if you didn't believe in anything, maybe. But that's how it's like slowly desensitizes mass media to the idea, and then only introduces that it's actually. You know,
the
Chinese people, they are all part of us, love is love.
Yeah. Stand-up comedian, he could say anything and people would accept it, but he said this something, and it was factual about transgender, and it was kicked off Netflix, it was...
Yeah. Dave Chappelle's Muslim.
Yeah.
I think he became Muslim in Africa. The idea of using positive symbols, like
the word gay itself.
Yeah. But even just the rainbow, it's like, how do you strip away the wonder of a rainbow? And the other words as well, like progressivism. Almost if somebody asks you, are you progressive, you'd want to say, yes, I'm progressive, because like, what am I going to say? I'm backward. But when you understand the connotations of what that means in a philosophical sense, then as a Muslim, no. I actually believe that the gold standard of morality existed 1400 years ago or more. The time of Rasulullah SAW, I don't believe that the further forward we go in society, the more morally advanced we're going to become. In fact, I think that society needs to revert to that. Does that make me backward? No. I think it's actually intellectual advancement that allows you to recognize that. But just the immediate response to somebody, if you're having a conversation with them and you ask them, are you progressive? They'll say, of course I'm progressive. I'm not backwards. But, you know, all of those using of words or symbols connected with positive connotations and then loading them with meanings that are not adhered to them is very it's very dangerous in society. So I don't know how that gets combated or what, but yeah. I'm not gonna lie to you, I never in my life thought I'm gonna be sitting and I'm 50 years old thinking about this stuff. But anything else? I honestly think that, and I had many discussions with Mullah Khalil about this as well as other scholars, that especially for youth that are going to university, and increasingly the need is the same for high schools, is that youth need to have some kind of prep course regarding these ideas. Because in my experience, most youth that go to university, they don't not get affected by these things on account of the strength of the argument. It's more on account of the deep-rootedness of their faith. So they are so deeply Muslim, I'm gonna take it now, right? They're so deep-rooted, I mean, the Islam is so deep-rooted, they're rooted in Islamic culture, the family is Muslim, whatever. So they push all of those things out of their mind, and that kind of defends them in a sense. And then they come out of university and they still have the Muslim circle and they carry on with life. And very few are those that can actually engage in the conversation and get the upper hand on an intellectual level. So I think there's a great need for having like prep courses for people. Because, I mean, even if you study engineering, you're probably going to have some course on ethics in which it's dependent on the lecturer whether he wants to engage in questions of predestination and all of those things. So, many university students would contact me, tell me, look here, how can it be that that Allah, you know, we believe in taqdeer, but then is Allah unjust? Not in a brew. Why do you need to know this now for this course that I'm doing? But when you're doing engineering, yeah, but I have to do this ethics course. And they engage in discussions. They don't care about they carry on with life as normal if they weren't forced to engage in the thing. But for many of them, it actually creates a moment of vulnerability. And in that moment of vulnerability, you can, you know, alter the ideas. So yeah,
could I ask a question?
Okay, Nana, just one moment. Somebody in the class wanted to say something, and then we'll take Nana's question, inshallah.
Speak about it.
No, the question is there a way that we can, you know, make the content of the Quran that is unchanging more accessible to the youth? I think there definitely is. You know, one of the things that somebody who has the expertise may be a better place to do is perhaps look at different, you know, theories of cognitive development and then identify for different age groups the, you know, the modes of learning, and then see what content is appropriate and what mode or what vehicle or means of conveyance is suitable for that type of content. And then we think about syllabi or, you know, pedagogies that actually enable us to access youth in those ways. I mean, I'm not an educational theorist or anything like that, so I don't read about Piaget, all of these people all the time. I mean, maybe I just read something on it now and then. I don't know why even, but like people that, the ensuring that there's a wholesome and holistic Muslim society is the responsibility of every Muslim. It's not the responsibility of a certain group of people. So people with all types of expertise need to put their heads together and see how that information or the expertise can be used beneficially. So people that are in education and that know about those things should come together with perhaps scholars, etc., to look at, you know, creating pedagogies that, that do that. And there are efforts like that that exist. There was this, Fons Vitae? They were publishing some stuff on Imam Ghazali's work, but Ghazali for children. So there are efforts like that afoot, and I think we need to invest more in them, and both financially and in terms of like.
I think internationally, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
Could I just make a comment? We are missing. Sorry, we are missing out on the comments and the questions from the floor. So could you just briefly repeat it before you respond to them? Thank you.
Okay, sure, no problem. And what was Nana's question? Nana, was that the question as well? Okay. So the comment that we're dealing with is, you know, since the content of the Quran is unchanging, are there ways in which we can, you know, make the content of the Quran more accessible to the youth? And so that's what we were talking about now. And I think one thing that we also mustn't do is we mustn't underestimate the capacity of our youth. Especially once they're into the teen years, especially in the latter teen years, oftentimes they can actually engage with the content of the Quran as it is. Maybe we just need to adapt the language and stuff like that. I don't know, once Mullah Khalil and I were working with MSR high schools, and we had to talk to like 1,000 high school youngsters. And we were not thinking to ourselves, look here, what on earth are we going to do here? We got 1,000 people to come, but I think we got them to come by offering them free chive and pizzas. So we had to speak to them. And then what I did was, I just got one of my cousins, I told him, look here, what are the words you people use nowadays? I remember at that time it was lit, low key, high key, and like, so I call some other stuff fam. So I'm gonna say fam all the time, like squad goals. I'm serious. So I just sat with my cousin and I told him, okay, tell me all those words. And then I just used that words in like in my talk and they could relate to it. The content was like the same. Yeah.
So what they do in the tablet is they say you must have Tallinn in the house and Tallinn University. Right? So after Maghrib, for example, in summer you have it in the masjid, just to run to the hadith from the Dalai Lama. And then at home you must sit with your family and 1, 2, 3 ahadith. Right? And in that way, from page 1 to page whatever in the book, you would have covered that from as soon as they understand, from age 5, for example, till they're 15, or until they leave high school.
Yeah.
So if you constantly do that, you could call it, they call it Tali, or you could call it indoctrination.
I think indoctrination just has a negative connotation.
Yeah. But let's call it Tali. And I keep on saying this to some of my friends and colleagues, that one of the most successful masajid in Cape Town is Portland's masjid, where Sheikh Ibrahim Gabriel, the night that I went there on a Saturday night, 2003, he would read a hadith or he'll use even a janaza salah at the person's house before they leave, he would give some advice. With the result, he said, in that masjid on a Saturday evening, for Maghrib, it would be 3/4. And as well for Isha Salah. So that tells me that because of the effort and the fikr that he has for his community, at ease and up to this, I think it's one of the most successful sites.
Even on a Thursday, they have the adhkar, and it's full of youth.
Yes. So this is what I'm saying, is that every night, the imam must speak. And you find that those imams that do not do this, they salah wa jama'ah is very, very few. You see? And now of COVID, there are some of our males that do not want to go to Jummah even. And it has broken that salah wa jama'ah, because now people feel, I don't need to go to the masjid. You know, the masjid is now on there, there's no social distancing, there's no mask. You go to square masjid, social distancing, they have to sanitize it, but they still have the mask also. You see? So it is up to the family then, the father figure in the house or the mother, to sit with the child, with the children, with the staff. And I came to a stage where I let the children read now when they were bigger. And they would read a hadith and they would not know the next word, and I could tell him the word for out in the book, and they tell me, how do you know that? But that was because of frequent reading. So this is another way of trying to
inoculate the youth also to the challenges. I think that's very important. So the comment was, for those online, the comment was that one of the things that we should institute are like practices like ta'aleem that have existed in various groupings like the Jama'ah, etc. Where you have ta'aleem that takes place in the masjid, and then you have ta'aleem that takes place at home. Where just maybe once a day there's a hadith read together, etc. I think that's very, very important then. But also serves as a platform for discussion. Where, you know, oftentimes people are so busy, parents are so busy, kids are so busy. It's not like they're really busy, but nowadays a kid can literally be busy all the time because they have their phone and stuff. And even parents are saying that you don't actually ever know what the kid's engaging with or what they're dealing with because of the fact that you don't have the platform for discussion. So when you actually have that institution in your house, look here, this time we're going to sit, we're going to read this thing, we're going to talk about it. That is a very, definitely a very effective thing. Another model very similar to that is the model of the halqa. The model of the halqa, where people get together, they read some Quran, read some hadith, read something from a book, something beneficial, and then they discuss it. Also very important.
I also heard that in Ta'arim, in Yemen, okay, they are at the stage where they read Imam Ghazali's Ikhwanuddin, like the Jamaat reads the Dalai Lama.
Yes.
They are on that stage of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of things in the Dalai Lama is actually quotations from
Ghazali's. Yes, yes. Not
but you cannot have nothing.
Yes. No, I agree. Certainly, I mean, we invest a super lot in our children's yeah, secular education. I mean, I'm not so comfortable calling it secular, but in that part of the education, and we are oftentimes very negligent in relation to the Islamic education, and it's detrimental, it shows.
So just Friday, you know, I was saying that one of the parents complained, so she's doing the creche from 6 months to 5 years old. And one of the parents complained that she was addressing to the children that, I don't know, first time I heard about it, is Momo on the phone.
And, Momo?
Yeah, and the one child was crying because Momo can hurt him, etc. The child couldn't sleep at night. So the wife said she doesn't know anything about it. And she asked the children what's Momo, and the child could say, Momo can do this to you, can kill you, and all that. But perhaps Momo cannot kill you, but the mother told them that Momo can kill you.
Mm.
Right? And then she then had to address to them what I told you not to look at ugly pictures, etc. Et mm. So this is the kind of thing that just tells you that the age of 3 is already exposed to.
Mm.
So if you don't have a talim and all other good stuff, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, phones are, I mean, we need them in a society, and there's a lot of good that can be derived from it. But children, I don't, children mustn't touch phones. They must be very, very controlled. Look here, I know it's the easiest pacifier, it's like a new age dummy. But what I actually recommend parents do, especially, is now, but sometimes the stuff pop up on the YouTube feeds and things. Yeah. Yeah. What I think parents must do is, even for like young adults or so. Okay, I know all about respecting privacy and stuff like that, but it must be, look, if you won't let me go through your phone, go on your phone. Obviously, there comes an age where you have to just trust them and make tawakkul, but it's very important, especially youth. Youngsters, they have access to too much. I actually say now, and I recommended this in my Friday Jumu'ah, because it's going to be Youth Day now. Everybody's going to speak about the youth and what the youth must be doing. But it's not about what the youth do. They're just a reflection of the society. I recommend that parents must not allow their children access to phones in general. Right? If you want to allow them to watch something, then you must put it on. And then, you know, they mustn't touch the phone. And there's ways that you can control that. You can rip the stuff off YouTube. I don't know if it's legal. If it's not legal, just don't tell anybody I said it, right? But for the well-being of the society, you download the stuff, rip the stuff, put it in a playlist that the child cannot click on anything other than things that you have already vetted, that you know it's safe, it represents good moral values, there's a good lesson in there. And then you can allow the child some degree of access to it. I'm not saying you must, you know, become Amish people or anything like that, but like, you wouldn't give your child a knife to play with. Why would you give something that's going to cut up the ideas? So that's what I strongly feel about YouTube. I mean, I try with my kid. I tell him, look here, here's a phone, don't touch. He touches it every single time.
But it's created that way.
Yeah, flash up, ads still pop up, all of those things. But there are ways to get around that. Is, I know I'm reading a tarsia of Quran while we're talking about YouTube and apps, but there's an app actually called YouTube Vanced. And it has some features that like are actually quite beneficial, that you can lock your phone while you're watching something. So the child won't be able to press a button, and there's no ads on there also. Cuts out all the ads and stuff. So we also need to update ourselves. Kids are getting updated with, and sometimes I speak about kids, but the problem applies to the whole spectrum, from children till young professionals, even beyond that, people are grappling with these problems. And there's apps that you can download to monitor screen on time on your phone. And empowering ourselves with what all of those things are that are available to us is very important in a society. But it's becoming also, as I say, there's other problems are becoming increasingly prevalent. What's also becoming increasingly prevalent is that people are living, by and large, online lives. Like, I know youth that literally spend their whole day online. Their friends, who they consider their real friends, are all online. I mean, because they do online gaming. So on the online gaming, they sometimes have headsets and they're speaking to other people, or they're typing and they're chatting. But I mean, I actually spoke to a few youth. I asked him, who are your friends? And he told me, no, I don't have any friends here. All my friends are overseas. So actually, a cousin of mine, a first cousin of mine, he's like, during COVID, his accent changed. So I was like, I'm not joking. It's actually, for me, it's a really serious thing, right? His accent changed. I asked him, like, bro, what's going on? Then he says, no, it's because of all the people he speaks to online. So he speaks like them. And then I engaged him, spoke to him about, like, who are your friends? Who's your friends here? What you do? He tells me all of his close friends. He doesn't have any friends. I asked him, now, what about your friends at school? He tells me, I talk to some people here and there, but, like, don't you do anything with them? Don't you go out to them? Don't you? No. All my friends are online. So how do you spend time with them? I spend time with them online. It seems like a laughable thing, but it's becoming very common. Becoming very common. But I think just in conclusion, I mean, I don't have all the solutions to all those problems. I don't think anybody has all of them. But some things we need to focus on. To become complacent. And I actually asked the cousin, I'm like, who hugs you when you're sad? Like, if all your friends are online, and you're not talking much to the people in your house, like, how do you have those needs fulfillment? I think highlighting the problems is not enough. We need to look for solutions, and I think some of the solutions, some things require simple solutions. Like I mentioned, just limiting access to to our online life. Even with younger adults, yeah, you can have a TV, you can play games, but you play in the front room.
I think also keeping close circles for as long as possible. Almost like a communication energy, like allowing children to go into almost like the wild too soon, and they're not really equipped to deal with all of these things. So keeping it close to the child for as long as possible, and then hopefully by then, all you can do is make the wise well.
Yeah.
In terms of preparing them early enough for as long enough, so that when they get to that, so they are going to get exposed to all these things, that they'll be able to deal with them.
So insulating children for a while until they're able to deal with things on their own. And then
I also think we estimate the value of the law which are marked by I don't think we have really seen the value of the law in terms of socializing.
Yeah, no, that I agree. Sometimes the solutions are resorting to very simple things that Rasulullah some advises. So Salat Jama'ah forces you to meet people, greet people, talk to people, get out of that the bubble. It's
all like-minded on a certain path.
Like-minded people on a certain path. There's accountability when you're in a community, all of those things. But anyways, what I think, what I want to say in conclusion, and I think, you know, maybe this is why Mawla Khalil, I was actually thinking as well, primarily Mawla Khalil, of teaching subjects like Aqidah and fiqh and discovering what is there, what exists there, how it applies to our society, all of those things. So inshallah, I think that education is becoming more and more important. Our time is up. And I know we didn't do any of the subjects we were supposed to do. But inshallah, may this be a discussion that gets us thinking about solutions. And then if you have any solutions in relation to anything, share it with everybody else. And I think it can be beneficial. To end me for now. جزاكم الله خيرا. أخذ دعوة الحمد لله رب العالمين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته شيخ.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته.